From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, journalist David Brock describes his journey from the right to the left. In the late 80s and the 90s, he was, as he puts it, a right-wing scandal reporter. He wrote the bestseller The Real Anita Hill, in which he described Hill as a kooky, man-hating leftist. He broke the Troopergate story. After growing disillusioned with the right and with his own ideologically slanted journalism, he moved to the left. He wrote a memoir called Blinded by the Right and started a website which monitors misinformation in the right-wing media. He's written a new book called The Republican Noise Machine. Also, Fresh Air book critic Maureen Carrigan gives us her picks for the best holiday books of 2004. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. President Bush wrapped up a two-day White House economic conference today in Washington. He called on Congress to set aside partisan differences and work together to fix the Social Security system. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Washington.
The president says he's open-minded about Social Security reform, but he's firm in his belief that the system must be fixed now, that it should be done without raising payroll taxes, and that a key component of the solution be allowing younger workers to privately invest part of what they currently pay into the system.
People are not going to be allowed to take their own money for the retirement account and take it to Vegas to shoot dice. This is going to be a managed account similar to the thrift savings plans that we federal employees have available to us now.
Still, critics say allowing people to take money out of the system means the government would have to borrow as much as $2 trillion to cover benefits being paid to current retirees. Don Gagne, NPR News, Washington.
After spending almost a year in custody, Saddam Hussein today met with his defense lawyer. NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro reports from Baghdad.
This is the first time that Saddam Hussein has been able to see a member of his defense team. He has a 20-strong defense team with over 1,500 volunteers that are working on his case. The meeting today is the very first time that they were able to meet face-to-face. They say that he is in good spirits and good health. However, very little else was said about the meeting.
NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro reporting from Baghdad. Today, Republican Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi has added his voice to those of Senators John McCain of Arizona and Susan Collins of Maine and expressed a lack of confidence in Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Speaking in Biloxi, Lott said he doesn't think Rumsfeld listens adequately to his uniformed officers, and he said more troops are needed in Iraq. Democratic Senator Evan Bayh of Indiana has just returned from a trip to Iraq. He was asked on NPR's All Things Considered whether he thinks Rumsfeld should step down.
Well, that's a question for the president. John McCain doesn't have confidence. I have lost confidence, and we'll have to see what the president's decision is.
Rumsfeld has been heavily criticized since a soldier asked him last week why combat vehicles in Iraq don't have enough armor. A new recording that appears on an Islamist website is attributed to Osama bin Laden, and it praises last month's attack on the U.S. consulate in Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Colin Powell says it appears to be bin Laden's voice, though its identity hasn't been definitively confirmed. The speaker on the recording accuses the Saudi royal family of misspending public money while millions of people suffer. He says the Saudi regime commits injustices against its own people. Stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Industrials up 14 points at 10,705. The Nasdaq was down 16 at 2146. The S&P down 2 at 1203. This is NPR News. Federal officials say a security guard who worked at a development where more than two dozen homes burned has been arrested and charged in the case. A 21-year-old man is to appear in federal court tomorrow. He is an employee of the company hired to guard the development outside Washington, D.C. 26 houses were damaged when fires broke out on December 6th. There had been some early speculation that the blazes were set by environmentalists opposed to the development, but police say that no such evidence has been found. A 12-year prison sentence for the Forest Service employee who started the biggest wildfire in Colorado's history was dismissed today. An appeals court judge said the sentence was too harsh. From Denver, NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
The Hayman fire started when Forest Service employee Terry Lynn Barton burned letters from her estranged husband. Campfires were banned at the time. The blaze scorched 138,000 acres, destroyed 300 buildings, and caused nearly $30 million in damage. It also forced 8,000 people from their homes in June of 2002. Among the evacuees was the judge who gave Barton the 12-year sentence. That's twice the normal maximum prison term. An appeals court said the sentence had at least the appearance of prejudice. She'll be resentenced later. The ruling does not affect a 6-year federal prison term Barton is serving. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
The widely publicized shortage of flu shots may have prompted too many people to skip the shots. Some health officials say restrictions on who can get the vaccination may lead to the waste of tens of thousands of doses. The Centers for Disease Control says more than half of the country's elderly or chronically ill adults have not tried to get flu shots this year. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, helping IT businesses locate, expand, and start up in Florida. Innovation Hub of the Americas, eflorida.com/tech.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, our guest was Richard Viguerie, one of the key figures in the development of the far right. He accused homosexual activists of being mean-spirited people with an anti-religious agenda. My guest today is David Brock. He's gay, but he was in the closet during the late 80s and early 90s when, as he puts it, he was the leading right-wing scandal reporter. He wrote the bestseller The Real Anita Hill, in which he now says he used a witch's brew of fact, allegation, hearsay, and invective to cast Hill as a vicious, kooky, man-hating leftist. Brock also wrote the Trooper Gate story based on interviews with Arkansas state troopers who said they wanted to go public about Bill Clinton's womanizing when he was the governor of Arkansas. After growing disillusioned with the right and his ideologically slanted journalism, Brock moved to the left. 2 years ago, he published a memoir called Blinded by the Right. This year, he started a media watchdog website called Media Matters for America, dedicated to monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation in the media. Brock also has a new book called The Republican Noise Machine, Right-Wing Media, and How It Corrupts Democracy. David Brock, welcome to Fresh Air. First of all, I think you have to answer this question. If you lied when you were on the right and wrote articles about Bill Clinton and Anita Hill that included fabrications and exaggerations, then why should we believe what you say now?
Right. That's a great question. And the fact is that in the act of confessing what I did that was wrong, you know, I knew that I was intentionally and quite knowingly raising a question about my own credibility. I mean, the only other alternative really would have been not to have confronted any of this and moved on in some other direction in my life. And I decided that for a variety of reasons that I wanted to confront this and I wanted to explain and educate people about what I had seen and what I had done. I mean, I think the only other thing I might say is that particularly in Blinded by the Right, which was published now in 2002, there were an awful lot of people who are characters in the book who certainly have the platform to contest and dispute what I've said. For the most part, they chose not to. There were some people who did contest various things, and I wrote a foreword or an afterword to the paperback edition of Blinded by the Right where I kind of went through that, and I think people can sift through that and make up their own mind.
You say that you had several reasons for wanting to explain your position in the right when you were on it, what you did there, and I'm wondering what a few of those reasons are, why you wanted to write your earlier book, Blinded by the Right, which was about what you did on the right and why you regret a lot of what you did.
Right. Well, I think a couple of things. One, and I think the most pressing reason, I had broken for the first time publicly with the conservative movement in the middle of 1997 in an article that I wrote for Esquire magazine called Confessions of a Right-Wing Hitman. Really, it was 7-8 months later during the impeachment when Hillary Clinton went on the Today Show and talked about a vast right-wing conspiracy, and I saw most people dismiss that as a delusion, that I really began to feel that I had some part of the history of what had happened that should be recorded, that I had been inside the anti-Clinton movement. I knew its operations. I knew a lot about its financing. And that was a part of the story that, for the sake of telling that part of the story, it would be a worthwhile project. So that was partly it. And I think partly I felt that in some way telling the story of what I did would help me move beyond that, that I felt badly. I felt stuck. And I thought that it would be a useful personal exercise for me.
Let's talk a little bit about your own political history. You found a place for yourself on the right after starting off in college being kind of on the left. What had alienated you about the left as you were on the verge of leaving it?
Well, I guess when I look back on it, I went to college at the University of California at Berkeley. It was in the early and mid-1980s. And I guess some of what I was experiencing was some version of what probably later came to be known as political correctness. And I felt that there was a kind of party line thinking on the left that didn't allow for contrasting points of view to be offered. And I gravitated toward conservatism. Now, there's a lot of irony in all that. You know, a lot of what happened in that period was a more of an emotional reaction to what I experienced and what I saw firsthand with I guess what you would consider the left. Then it was a reasoned position, and I ended up going from kind of one side to another rather than kind of ending up in the reasonable middle.
Were there certain issues that particularly resonated with you on the right when you moved to that side?
Well, yeah. At that time, it was issues of foreign policy and military strength. So that was primarily it. I was never attracted, and even when I later became a prominent person in the conservative movement, never attracted by the social agenda of the right. And in fact, I guess the Christian Coalition didn't really exist, when I was beginning to start identifying myself with conservatism in 1984, 85, and 86.
But the moral majority did.
And did
already exist. In fact, you were gay.
Right.
And as are gay.
Yes.
And as you say, you didn't subscribe to the conservative social agenda. And so when you were closeted and on the right, what was it like for you being a part of a larger political movement that opposed homosexuality? What was it like for you knowing you were on the team that really opposed who you were?
Right. Well, I think basically it caused me to divorce myself in a certain way from who I was. And in retrospect, although it didn't really seem so at the time, I think that the fact that I was having this inner struggle with my self-identity actually was enabled me to deny not only that, but other things that were going on around me and some of the things that I was doing myself. And I also at the same time think that if I look back on it, that I publicly acknowledged that I was gay in 1994 when I was still very much a part of the conservative movement. And I look back on that as a critical first step toward being able to be independent and kind of, you know, a self-validating kind of act that also gave me strength to later get out of the conservative movement. But it was a very conflicted existence. I had been actually openly gay in college. And when I came to Washington, my first job was with a weekly magazine published by the Washington Times called Insight. And I gradually went into the closet as I rose through conservative circles. Now, if you ask about, you know, what was the attitude among the conservative elite toward gays, that's a little complicated and it's a mixed picture. I think that on the one hand, there are there are conservative leaders who, for their own reasons, their own values, oppose homosexuality. That really, wasn't so much the crowd that I was in. I mean, there's another part of the conservative establishment, I think, that doesn't really pass moral judgment, but feels compelled to pander to that homophobia that does exist in the base of the Republican Party. And so there was a lot of public posturing that didn't really match up with how, for example, how I was treated.
My guest is David Brock. His new book is called The Republican Noise Machine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Brock, and his new book is called The Republican Noise Machine, Right-Wing Media, and How It Corrupts Democracy. The way you lay it out in your book, conservatives have organized a campaign over the past few decades to be better represented on the media. And you see it as an organized campaign that involves think tanks, foundations, journalists. Let's start with the think tanks. What do you see as the role of the think tanks? What the role of conservative think tanks, foremost among them, the Heritage Foundation?
Right. Well, I spent a year at the Heritage Foundation in 1990, and I think that really, if you go back to the formation of these think tanks in the 1970s. They are really the center of a kind of message machine for the conservative movement. And so the content, the issue framing, the jargon, the way various conservative programs are spoken of, are all invented in these ideas factories, I suppose you would call them. But I really feel the emphasis in these institutions is very, very much on branding and marketing and selling the conservative ideology, making it palatable, so that today I really think that almost everything you know about the conservative movement agenda will have been the result of years of work in these think tanks. And today I think the number is up to, more than 700 of these kinds of organizations in Washington alone. That's massive intellectual infrastructure, so that, school vouchers and the death tax and Social Security privatization, even the doctrine of military preemption, all of these things are the product of years of work. And I think that this is really the key to how conservatives have been able over time to capture our political discourse. With the goal of moving the country to the right.
Some of the think tanks are funded by conservative foundations. You see the conservative foundations as having played a very important role in the growth of the conservative movement and in the way that the conservative movement has increasingly been able to figure out how to use the media to get its message across. Or to how to be better represented in the media. Why don't you describe which are the leading conservative foundations in terms of the amount of money and influence they have, and describe some of the ways they've used the money.
Okay, well, when this started, again, we're going back to the 1970s, and we're talking about a conservative movement, financiers who at that time were a minority even within the Republican Party. So this was, building this movement was a very tall order, because the first thing that had to happen was to gain influence within the Republican Party before one could move further than that. And so, You had people like the first check written for the Heritage Foundation was from the Coors brewery fortune in Colorado. Some of the other primary actors have been over the years, the Olin Foundation, which is based in New York City, the Bradley Foundation in Milwaukee, the Koch brothers in the Midwest, which is an oil and gas fortune. The one that I had personal experience with was the various SCAFE foundations that are based in Pittsburgh, run by a billionaire named Richard Mellon SCAFE, who himself, I believe the figures have been put at something like $350 to $400 million just personally through these foundations that Richard Mellon SCAFE has poured into the conservative movement.
Your new book is called The Republican Noise Machine. What is the noise machine?
Well, the noise machine is, it's one part the think tanks that we talked about, which I say is the core of the message machine. And then there are ways in which that message is disseminated through both explicitly Republican-oriented or conservative-oriented media and the mainstream media. And so you have, the easiest way for me to explain this is to just put it back in personal terms as to how this landscape has changed. I came to Washington in 1986 working at this magazine published by the Washington Times. At the time, in 1986, the Washington Times had a circulation of 100,000. Reverend Moon had founded it as a right-wing alternative to the Washington Post, was losing tens of millions of dollars a year to subsidize this newspaper. The journalistic practices there were low and shoddy, as I described in Blinded by the Right. The difference is, in 1986, the Washington Times circulation reached 100,000 subscribers. If you go flash forward to 2004, the Washington Times still has a circulation of 100,000, flat over all those years. Reverend Moon is still losing tens of millions of dollars a year to prop that newspaper up. But today, a false or wrong or distorted article in the Washington Times will be read on the air by Rush Limbaugh, reaching 15 to 20 million people. An author of that article can go on the O'Reilly Factor, reaching another 5 to 10 million people. Matt Drudge can post that Washington Times article on his website and reach another, say, 6 million people. Many of them are not just conservatives, but they're TV talk show producers and bookers who are using that as a kind of tip sheet. And so the capacity to disseminate the propaganda of the conservative movement has increased exponentially in that, whatever that is, 18-year time frame. And I just really think that that is a critical piece of what has happened politically in this country that I think still now is insufficiently appreciated in many ways, particularly by liberals and Democrats.
One of the articles that you became famous for when you were on the right was your article about how the Arkansas state troopers used to help then-Governor Clinton get women and keep his affairs secret. Is that a fair way of describing it?
Yes.
You've used the expression the anti-Clinton movement. Did you see that piece as being part of a larger movement to get Clinton?
Yes, absolutely it was. When I spoke earlier about the vast right-wing conspiracy, the way I see it is a conspiracy is a wrongful scheme. And so a lot of what we've discussed about the burgeoning strength of conservative media or the think tank network, that's not a wrongful scheme. Specifically, what I mean by this is that there were people, and I was involved with them in 1992, prior to Clinton's election, but then accelerating once Clinton won the presidency, who put money in place, put a system in place, used institutions that had already been built up, such as the American Spectator magazine where I worked, to try to destroy and upend the Clinton presidency. There were people that I worked with in 1993, including someone who was instrumental in getting that Trooper Gate story that you just referred to, getting that to me, who were openly using the word impeachment 5 years before anybody knew the name Monica Lewinsky. There was more than $2 million put just into this small magazine. And this, at the time, this is a small, 30,000 circulation magazine, intentionally to dig up, to go back into the Arkansas days of the Clintons, intentionally to dig up dirt with no regard for whether the allegations were true or not, to put them into the public domain, to discredit, to throw sand in the gears so that it would be more difficult for Clinton to govern. The Trooper Gate article, one of its results was that I had mentioned only the first name of Paul Jones, not knowing the full story, but that had been an anecdote in that article, and it caused Paula Jones to come forward, and what she said was to try to attempt to clear her name for having been mentioned in this article, and she sued President Clinton for sexual harassment, and that became a vehicle that was a vehicle for the impeachment. And so there were a group of lawyers who were not the lawyers for Paula Jones publicly in the public documents, but a group of so-called elves, of conservative activist lawyers, all linked through the Federalist Society, which is a network of conservative legal talent. And they were really, in many ways, calling the shots and doing the strategy on the case. And I came to know, because I asked, whether one of these lawyers who was really leading the charge believed his own client. And not only did he say no, but he explained to me before this actually happened that the discovery process in the Jones case was really focused on not justice for Paul Jones, but digging deeper and deeper into Clinton's private, consensual, alleged sexual activities to try to trip him up, to essentially put him in this perjury trap. And when I look back on the Clinton years, it increasingly seems to me that what happened and what I was involved in had virtually nothing to do with the Clintons, but really was related to the fact that the Clintons represented a threat to Republican power.
David Brock's new book is called The Republican Noise Machine, Right-Wing Media and How It Corrupts Democracy. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Tree, A New Vision of the American Forest by photographer James Balog, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, David Brock describes his experiences writing the Trooper Gate story. Also, book critic Maureen Carrigan has some gift ideas. She's made up her list of the best holiday books of 2004.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Brock. In the late 80s and the early 90s, he wrote for conservative publications. He describes himself as having been the leading right-wing scandal reporter. He wrote the bestseller The Real Anita Hill, in which he cast Hill as a mean-spirited, man-hating leftist. He broke the Troopergate story. He grew disillusioned with the right and his own ideologically motivated journalism. He now runs the website Media Matters for America, which he describes as monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation in the media. His new book is called The Republican Noise Machine, Right-Wing Media, and How It Corrupts Democracy. Getting back to the Troopergate article that you wrote, which was published in the American Spectator, how did you get onto this story?
Well, actually, I was approached by a man named Peter Smith, who was a wealthy financier based in Chicago, who was on the National Finance Committee of Newt Gingrich's Political Action Committee, who I had met briefly once before in Washington, and had a telephone acquaintanceship with. And he called me, I guess this is going back to August of 1993, so Clinton would have been in office just 6 months, and said that he knew about a group of Arkansas state troopers who had stories that they wanted to tell on Bill Clinton, and would I be willing to go down to Arkansas, that they were being organized and managed by somebody named Cliff Jackson, whose name was familiar to me because he had been very vocal in 1992, pursuing Clinton on various questions related to the draft controversy in Clinton. And so I recognized the name. And so Peter sent me to Arkansas, and I was met at the airport by Cliff Jackson and taken to a hotel where I debriefed this group of troopers. So it was instigated in that sense by somebody who had a clear political agenda. Around the same time, Richard Mellon Scaife was beginning to put money into the American Spectator for these kinds of anti-Clinton stories.
Is the story that you wrote true?
Well, that's a great question. What I would say about that is this. I had a group of troopers and spent a long time with them. The Los Angeles Times was working on a similar story and spent some hours and actually published a piece as well as the American Spectator. What's troubling about the article is, in terms of its credibility, is that, the troopers had an original group of four, and they were all put under oath, ultimately, in the Paula Jones case. And if you look at the depositions in that case, now this is some years later, I'm writing in 1993, they really don't stand behind what they told me. Some of them say that these were really just old fish tales told around the guard shack. So there's a serious question, I think, about whether they were embellishing. And so what I say is basically, any of that detail is very hard to stand behind. Because you just don't really know. After I did those interviews and after I published the article and after the Los Angeles Times published the article, two of the troopers who were the ones who really put themselves out publicly appeared in an anti-Clinton video that Jerry Falwell did. They were paid for that. They began to make allegations claiming some knowledge that Vincent Foster, the White House counsel under Clinton, had died in some way other than a suicide. And so they began to tell stories that even, from my point of view then, were increasingly outlandish and very difficult to believe. And so at the end of the day, I would say, it's just something that couldn't be believed, yeah.
So you don't have faith in what you publish. You think a lot of it is embellished or not true.
Right. I think that's that. And as I said, it's hard to know which parts.
Okay.
But all I can say is that I don't think the sources in retrospect were credible. And I certainly didn't do a very good job in trying to track down, say, you know, I kind of parachuted in and out of Little Rock and did these interviews in isolation. And when I really started to have second thoughts was when I started to write a book about Hillary Clinton. Subsequent to publishing this Troopergate article, and spent a lot of time in Arkansas. And then I began to appreciate that there was really a real stew of gossip, that the place just reeked of that. And I began to think, well, you know, this kind of thing is just not, it's really not up to the standard, certainly not up to the standard that if one is publishing this about a sitting president that one would do. And I think any news organization, you know, I mean, if you looked at those depositions later, it's hard to square that with what they said earlier.
Did any of these questions bother you when you were writing the Troopergate story?
Not really, no. And I think there are a couple reasons for that. I mean, one is, if you look at the journalistic training I had coming out of the Washington Times, was really, it was a very, very partisan place. And you were taught to be able to kind of skew things and organize things in a certain way to, communicate a point of view, wasn't objective. So I was coming and working at the American Spectator, I was coming at it with a different set of standards and a different kind of training. I was concerned about its impact, but I really wasn't so concerned with, you know, it sounded like what they were saying was true. I was concerned about what the impact of the story would be. I was also concerned there was an undercurrent during that whole period that somehow Peter Smith wanted to help these troopers out financially, and it ended up, of course, that money was given to the troopers after these articles were published. That was something that was troubling. But I more or less took them at their word at the time.
What was the impact the Troopergate story had on your career right after it was published?
Well, I think it was a major impact. I was already controversial for having written a book defending Clarence Thomas and attacking Anita Hill that was published in the same year, and earlier in 1993. And then this was kind of a second fairly high-profile news event within a short period of time. And conservative movement was just, there were a few critics, but overall, I mean, I think they were just thrilled that this kind of thing was happening. And so it was a big boost for my career, and I ended up selling a biography of Hillary Clinton for a lot of money not long thereafter. So it was, it continued along the lines of what I had established with Anita Hill.
My guest is David Brock. His new book is called The Republican Noise Machine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Brock. His new book is called The Republican Noise Machine, Right-Wing Media and How It Corrupts Democracy. He used to write for conservative publications. Your Troopergate story was the first time that Paula, who we later found out was Paula Jones, was mentioned, and that was like the first part of the story that eventually led to other sexual allegations that led to the impeachment of President Clinton. So I'm wondering if you feel at all personally responsible in some part for the impeachment.
Yeah, I very much do, because I mean there were a series of events, and one of the triggers was the Troopergate article in the American Spectator, and I think that a lot of the anti-Clinton sentiment, the animosity, a lot of the forces that were arrayed to try to prevent Bill Clinton from governing would have been there anyway, but the precise way that the story unfolded did have a fair amount to do with something that I caused to happen, which was the publication of this article and the mention of Paula. And so by 1998, when I watched Clinton being hauled into this deposition in the Paul Jones case, I felt very much responsible personally, even though, as I say, I mean, you can never know what would have happened otherwise, but I did feel that I had some culpability. And this is why I began talking out about it. I mean, this is why I wrote a letter, an open letter to President Clinton in the spring of 1998, beginning to tell the story, beginning to reveal that there was a Gingrich Political Action Committee money behind some of this stuff, and beginning to talk to other reporters, cooperating with people who were writing books about all this, and then ultimately writing my own memoir about this, because I really felt that this was, for people who were just, particularly just watching television news, they really weren't seeing the whole story here. There really was a, there was a structure, there was an attack machine, there was an intention that really came before Monica Lewinsky.
What was behind your change of heart in slowly starting to shift from the right to the left? What were some of the precipitating incidents or changes of heart that you had that helped explain that change?
Well, the big one was, you know, I had written a book defending Clarence Thomas and attacking Anita Hill, and believing that that account was correct when I wrote it, even though it was taking only one side of the story, I had no reason to think that that the people who were cooperating with me, the supporters of Clarence Thomas, were telling me anything other than the truth. You know, I published that book in 1993. In the 2 years subsequent to that, I became much closer to the people who were close to Clarence Thomas. And I started to feel over that time that that I had been sold a bill of goods, and that they themselves had serious doubts about whether Clarence Thomas had done the things that Anita Hill said he did, that their representations to me, that he was pure as a driven snow and nothing like this could have ever happened, were wrong and didn't even reflect their own views. That really started to shake my foundations. Rather than acting on that feeling that I had at the time, I did the opposite. I became a stronger defender of Clarence Thomas, and I wrote an article in the American Spectator that was a book review of a book called Strange Justice, which had some new evidence in it that was incriminating of Clarence Thomas and was kind of helpful to the case that Anita Hill had made. And I just found out things by then about Clarence Thomas that I withheld from readers in that article. I attacked the authors of that book in a really disgusting way. At this point, I felt like I was just compromised, whether that was partly for the ideological cause, partly because I had a successful career at stake, probably some combination of all of that. But that was really my low point. And I think I gradually started to come up from that point. And when I started to write a book about Hillary Clinton, which while it was still framed in a conservative direction, certainly I resisted a lot of the conclusions that the conservatives were making at the time because the evidence didn't add up. And I was just starting to be able to parse things more independently. I certainly had all the same Republican access that I had for the Anita Hill book. But I began, as a result of that experience of feeling misled by people and that I had been compromised and that I lied in print, I was much, much more resistant to a lot of the Republican efforts to have an indictment drawn up of Hillary Clinton. And I didn't write that indictment, and I didn't end up spending the $60 or $70 million that Ken Starr spent to conclude in 1996 that there wasn't anything here to Filegate and Travelgate and Whitewater and these real estate deals. And so, you know, that was a big part of the transition that I made.
Were you reprimanded by colleagues when your Hillary Clinton book wasn't the strongly critical book that people on the right were expecting?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, in fact, the wife of Clarence Thomas, Ginny Thomas, was co-hosting an end of the congressional season session party in Washington right at the time the Hillary Clinton book came out. And I was telephoned and disinvited from that party, the Washington Times, the morning the book came out. Where I had worked for some years, painted me on the front page as an apologist for Hillary Clinton. And so there were some serious repercussions. I heard from the publisher of the American Spectator that Richard Mellon Scaife, who had been a financial benefactor, was extremely unhappy. So, you know, all of that, I suppose, is predictable. But it still had a sting to me because, again, I didn't have much of a life outside the conservative movement. I didn't understand a lot about friendship. These were relationships. That's really all I knew. I was in a very small world. And so it ended up having a lot of personal consequences as well. And the excommunication ended up becoming a little bit of a two-way street. But, yes, I was definitely not welcome in a lot of conservative quarters.
I don't know if you think of yourself as having been on a crusade when you were on the right, but did you think of yourself as being on a crusade then, and do you think of yourself as being on a crusade now? And and if so, I'm wondering if you think you have to be careful of the crusading instinct.
Right. That's something I'm conscious of, and something I question quite a bit in myself. You know, I didn't make the transition in my life or the shift in my life abruptly. It was at least for me a long period of time over the course of several years. I did not wake up one day and jump out of bed and say, you know, I'm going to become a liberal. It also was not primarily over issues. I didn't suddenly say, you know, supply side economics doesn't make sense. It was very much about issues of character and honesty. And it took me quite some time to kind of find my footing again. It took, you know, three long, probably more years of writing Blinded by the Right, and then another few years on top of that. And so I feel like the search I've been on has taken some time, was not abrupt. I don't feel that crusading instinct originally, I think, in me had a lot to do with a mischanneled emotional energy that I was very focused on, you know, hating the Clintons or hating Anita Hill. And that wasn't the case. A lot of it had to do with hating myself. And so I have a much more balanced life outside of my job now, and I think it's not the same thing. But I'm aware of that temptation, and I'm aware of a lot more self-aware of issues of emotional makeup. But I feel like I have some understanding of the right wing. I know their vulnerabilities, and I want to help people understand it, and I wanted to take a role in fighting it.
Well, David Brock, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
David Brock's new book is called The Republican Noise Machine, Right-Wing Media, and How It Corrupts Democracy. His website is Media Matters for America. Coming up, some holiday gift ideas from book critic Maureen Carrigan. This is Fresh Air. Okay, you might want to get out your pens and pencils. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has her list of the best books of the year and holiday recommendations.
The widespread critical verdict on 2004 is that it was a really great year for nonfiction, only a so-so year for fiction. It seems silly to concur, given that this was a year when Tom Wolfe and Colm Tobin each brought out a superb novel. Wolfe's satire of undergraduate life in today's universities, called I Am Charlotte Simmons, and Tobin's smart, spellbinding evocation of the inner life of Henry James, called The Master. But what really makes me think twice about this general judgment on the year in literature is Philip Roth's spectacular novel, The Plot Against America. Set in the 1940s, Roth's book is a dystopian fantasy that imagines the folk hero aviator and fascist sympathizer Charles Lindbergh defeating Franklin Roosevelt in the presidential election of 1940. In accord with Roth's trademark sly style, the narrator here is a young boy named Philip Roth, whose, of course, Jewish family lives in a suburb of Newark, New Jersey. The Newark familiar to Roth fans slowly, believably becomes strange when Lindbergh's administration, under the auspices of the newly formed Office of American Absorption, begins implementing programs designed to assimilate Jews into the Gentile American mainstream. The workings of Roth's political allegory never overwhelm the emotional immediacy of his story, or its you-are-there sense of lived authenticity. Take young Philip's description of Roosevelt's voice on the radio. "We listened on the radio to Roosevelt's speech, delivered with the confidently intoned upper-class enunciation that for close to 8 years now had inspired millions of ordinary families like ours to remain hopeful in the midst of hardship. There was something about the inherent decorum of the delivery that, alien though it was, not only calmed our anxiety, but bestowed on our family a historical significance, authoritatively merging our lives with his, as well as with that of the entire nation, when he addressed us in our living room as his fellow citizens." Yet with all deference to Roth's brilliant achievement here, the nonfiction standouts this year were so collectively startling in the way they revisited and reinvigorated what seemed to be all but exhausted subjects that I can see why in many critics' minds they collectively nudged even the most heavyweight novels to the side, let alone terrific comic novels like Tom Perrotta's send-up of suburban mommy culture, Little Children, and Karen Joy Fowler's romp with literary references, The Jane Austen Book Club. In that happily overcrowded category of great nonfiction, Will in the World by Stephen Greenblatt is my nominee for Book of the Year. It's a biography of the bard like no other, one that attempts to solve the enduring mystery of how Shakespeare, a modestly educated young man from the provinces, became the greatest playwright of all time. Greenblatt's revelatory book pays tribute to the glorious democracy of Shakespeare's art by the openness and easy elegance of his own writing style. Trailing Will in the World by a fairy feather is Kevin Boyle's stunning narrative history, Arc of Justice. The events Boyle recounts were set in motion by the quintessential American dream of home ownership. In 1925, a young black doctor named Ocean Sweet put a down payment on a bungalow in a white section of Detroit. Mob violence erupted after Sweet and his wife moved in, and a white man was killed. In the ensuing nail-biter of a courtroom drama, defense attorney Clarence Darrow astonishingly reframed the case into one in which American racism itself was put on trial. The incendiary topics of race and difference also figure in Clea Kaff's book, The Bone Woman, an admirably restrained account of her recent work as a forensic anthropologist at the sites of genocidal atrocities around the world. Other very honorable mentions in the nonfiction category this year are the biographies Woodhouse by Robert McCrum, Nightingales by Gillian Gill, and The Americanization of Ben Franklin by Gordon S. Wood. Two extraordinary non-sentimental books on friendship were Ann Patchett's Truth and Beauty, a nuanced autobiography of her relationship with the late writer Lucy Greeley, and Rachel Cohen's Informed History of American Literary and Artistic Friendships, A Chance Meeting. Finally, a suggestion for a last-minute stocking stuffer, and make that stocking extra, extra large if you take me up on this hefty tip. The just-published new annotated Sherlock Holmes, edited by respected Sherlock scholar Leslie S. Klinger and introduced by John le Carré, is a two-volume boxed feast for any fans of the greatest detective who ever stalked the earth. Among its other eccentricities, this new edition reassembles the 56 short Holmes stories in their original book publishing order, and includes over 700 illustrations that originally accompanied the stories. For the right reader, the gift of this edition of the Holmes canon would be elementary.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Her best books list is up on our website, freshair.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bill Moyers is about to retire from his weekly PBS series. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to excerpts of interviews with Moyers from our archive. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.